So before we get into the nitty-gritty, I'd like to hear from each of our guests about why you decided to attend a historically black college. And for anyone who's not familiar, these are institutions that were established before 1964 with the purpose of educating black Americans when other institutions would not. Students of all races are welcome, but black culture is often celebrated to a high degree at these places. So Amos, let's start with you. Why did you choose Howard?
Okay. I was recruited out of Florida for football by a lot of institutions, primarily in the Ivy League institutions in the Patriot League, so Georgetown, Fordham, Bucknell. And funny enough, I had no intention of going to an HBCU. I actually came on an unofficial visit to Georgetown during the summer going into my senior year of high school. And my parents were like, you need to go visit Howard. My whole family went to HBCUs. My dad went to FAMU. My sister went to Bethune-Cookman. My grandmother went to Edward Waters, and so I have an HBCU family. And I was like, no, I want to be different. I want to go to a top-tier institution. I don't want to go to an HBCU. And then, funny enough, I didn't get the ACT score for those institutions that were recruiting me. I took it twice. I was like, I don't want to take it anymore. I'm done. I needed like two more points on it, and I decided not to take it. And so I committed to this small Division III school in Cleveland, Ohio. And ironically, one Sunday at church, I met this guy, and he was like, where are you going to school? Just constant conversation at the church. And he was like, I was like, John Carroll. He's like, why are you going there? You have all this talent, like you're an athlete, you do theater, you sing, and all that. Why are you going to a small Division III school? And I told him, I said, I don't know. This is where I got in. And he was like, you have to go to Howard. I said, So he invited me to this Sigma Pi Phi Boule chapter meeting where they were doing like youth development stuff. And he set me up by bringing all of these prominent Howard alum that lived in Florida. But even at that meeting, like the chair of our board, ironically, who I would be hosting a protest against 3 years later, was there. And I was like, okay, I called my dad that day and I was like, I'm going to Howard. And so you would think that someone is like that played football, was involved, pledged a fraternity, and now as SGA president, that I've always dreamed about going to an HBCU. That necessarily wasn't my initial decision, but I believe that it was the greatest decision I've ever made. This has made me more confident in myself as a black man, understanding the black diaspora, and getting an education that centered around me as a black man, me as an African American in America. And so I think that every black student should go to an HBCU. It wasn't something that I understood early on, but it's something that I really understand now and is going to promote forever.
Very cool. Kyle, let's hear your story.
Okay, so growing up, starting from the first grade up until the seventh grade, I went to predominantly white elementary, middle schools. So I dealt with racism at a very young age. So I knew going into high school, well, when I was in the eighth grade, my brother graduated from high school. He went off to college. He went to FAMU. So I started looking into what HBCUs were, what they were really about, and why they were important to people who look like me. And when I got to high school, I started going on college tours, and my church every year held black college tours. So I went on a black college tour with my church and fell in love with all the HBCUs from Tennessee State to Hampton and Spelman, everywhere. So I knew by about the ninth or tenth grade that I wanted to go to a HBCU. So I started narrowing it down as to what HBCUs I wanted to go to specifically. So when I finally got to my junior and senior years and it was time to, you know, take the ACT and apply to college, I applied to 7 universities that were black and 2 that were PWIs, or predominantly white institutions. And the PWIs I simply applied to because they were close to home and they were like backups just in case something fell through with like financial aid or scholarship money. But I knew in my heart that I wanted to go to a HBCU. I got scholarship money, fortunately, to go to Hampton. Hampton gave me the highest scholarship. So I knew in my heart it was a beautiful campus. They had a top-tier journalism program and everything in between. I knew I wanted to be surrounded by people who looked like me, who acted like me and who had the same morals and values as me, and I didn't want to succumb to racism for any longer. So I knew that HBCU was the perfect place for me, where I knew I would fit in, I knew I would be accepted, and for the last 4 years, I've felt exactly like that. So it was literally the best decision I've made. My children will be attending HBCUs. They don't have a choice. And that is it.
That's funny. I'm glad that you're declaring it now. Yvette, what about you?
I have a pretty cliche story, I would say, which is I was first introduced to HBCUs through a different world, pre-Bill Cosby problems that we have now. And I knew very early on, I was watching reruns in seventh grade, that I wanted to attend a historically black college or university. Like, I wanted that experience for myself. And so I encountered some struggles when I got to high school and ended up dropping out when I was 16. And HBCUs were the only institutions who were willing to accept someone who took the SAT but did not have a traditional high school diploma. And so I applied to three HBCUs. The one I decided initially to attend was the University of Maryland Eastern Shore. And I attended there for a year and then encountered some money troubles, because that sometimes happens at any institution that you go to. And so I was actually sitting at home. I had taken a semester off watching CNN, and I saw Bennett College's former president, Dr. Julianne Malvo, just talking about this school I'd never heard of before. And she was just singing all of its praises. Like, if you're a black girl who wants to turn into a black woman and be educated and celebrated, like, this is the school that you should go to. And I ended up applying that day. Got my recommendation letters that week, and I was accepted probably 6 or 7 weeks later, and decided to transfer to Bennett, which is where I graduated from in 2012. And I'll agree with both of the people who went before me that it's the best decision I've ever made.
Oh, I love that. I feel like I'm a combination of like all of you guys a little bit. Like Kyla, I'm from New Mexico. Black people make up 2% of the state population. So it's mainly white and Mexican. I was nowhere near an HBCU. My parents both went to Howard, so that was the only connection I had. And I was determined to be different from them. So when I was applying to schools, I really had no intention of going to an HBCU. Like Kyla, my father told me I had to apply to at least one. That was a rule for all of my siblings as well. And so I applied to Howard because that was the one that I knew. And I ended up getting a full ride, but I still didn't want to go. And my dad, I was choosing between Wellesley in Boston, or just outside of Boston, and Howard. And I had this kind of heart to heart with my dad, and I just realized that I was really disconnected from the black community. And I was really I wanted to learn more about what it meant to be black. And so even though Howard, it scared me, because I was like, I don't know what I'm getting into. What if I'm not accepted? But like everyone else, it was the best decision ever. And I certainly have my critiques of Howard, but I love that place. I'm glad everybody enjoyed their experience, because we all know some people who did not enjoy their experiences at HBCU. Which brings me, by the way, I feel like you can't talk about HBCUs without talking about the dating scene at those places. I don't know about y'all, but I mean, that's one of the first things that came up. Like, once you start, after you get past the blackness and I'm black and I'm proud, you start talking about how beautiful the women are, how fine the men are, and all of that. So what do you all think about the dating scene at your campuses right now? And, or when you went there? Let's start with you, Kyla.
Okay, well, first of all, at Hampton, the ratio male to female is like, don't quote me, but it's something like 15 women to one guy.
Oh my
God.
So
yes, so it is so crazy. It is extremely difficult to find a guy or find a guy that'll be loyal, because there literally can be 14 other girls talking to him and you probably will never know about her. So I've literally never had a boyfriend in college. Like, I've never dated a guy at Hampton. Like, it's just the whole trying to talk to multiple girls at one time and trying to just, it's so cliche to me. It's really corny. I mean, of course, the guys are really, really cute, but if you have nothing in your mind and all you want to do is talk to multiple women at one time, I'm way too old to be trying to deal with that. So the dating scene at Hampton for me is really low. So my boyfriend will be from another university, HBCU, hopefully, because Hampton is not the wave. I just can't do it. I can't get with it.
I get it. Okay, you sound like you have something to say, Amos. Go for it.
Well, at Howard, it's 7-1, female to male. And so as a guy, it's great, but it's also very challenging to the same point that Kyla raised. I've had a girlfriend every year. I'm going into my first year at Howard, not with a girlfriend. So this is going to be interesting. And so I'm really just like, I'm trying to stay focused, but so many beautiful, black, intelligent women at Howard University. So it's one of those things where you just really have to understand, you really got to have discernment to understand, like, who is really for you and who's not. One of the things that I've realized, like, being at Howard, and I'm sure at other institutions as well, like, when you, like, accomplish things, like, people just start liking you more. And it's like, do you like me because of what I accomplished, or do you like me because, like, of who I am? Because you don't even know me.
Right.
And you're telling me all these great things about me. You don't know me. You just see me, what I do. So one of those things. So, like, I probably won't date anybody this year because I ain't dating nobody in my class, and everybody else after that doesn't really know me. And so I'll probably be venturing off to another campus as well.
He'll be going to Hampton.
I don't know about all that. Maybe Spelman. Maybe Spelman Bennett.
Wow. Okay, Yvette, what do you when you were an undergrad? And I guess Yvette and I should say, I don't want to speak for Yvette. I was in undergrad a little bit over about 13 years ago. Yvette, what about you?
Yeah, I finished undergrad 6 years ago. Okay. So it has been a while. But I attended a same-sex college, and so the dating was a little difficult unless you wanted to venture to another campus. But thankfully, Bennett is, like, down the street and around the corner from North Carolina A&T. So a lot of the dating was happening across campuses, or mostly Bennett girls were going to North Carolina A&T because our college didn't allow men on campus. And when they did come on campus, they were being harassed by security. They were not allowed to go into our dormitory rooms if you lived on campus. They had to stay in the parlor. And so if you had a male visitor who wanted to come by, he would, like, become a spectacle. And
wait,
so a lot of the dating that
we
did.
Men were not allowed on campus?
To a degree. They had to be off campus. Basically, when it got dark, they had to be off campus. And if they did come to your dormitory, they had to stay in, like, a common area. And so it was just a little awkward. Like, you're an adult. You know, I'm 22. I was a resident assistant. And I'm dating someone who has to sit in the living room, essentially, because they can't come to my room. It just made it really, really awkward. So a lot of the dating I did then was happening off campus or on North Carolina A&T's campus, but never on Bennett's campus.
Wow. Oh, HBCUs. So I just have to say, I mean, echo all of, like, well, except for I was at Howard, so men were allowed. I think what's really interesting about HBCUs is that as much as dating can be challenging because of the ratios, it's often more women to men, that it was the first time I had ever been chosen. Like, I felt like, I felt like it's this really powerful experience to, like, be desired and to, like, pursue people and to have it be successful. So I feel like my black friends at predominantly white schools have not had that experience. And I think it really shapes you. So even though there was drama, I do appreciate Howard for that. But this kind of makes me move on to my next question for you guys. So I feel like if you're going to talk about dating, you definitely have to talk about sex and decision making around having sex, like safe sex, choosing the right partner, making sure everything's consensual and everything's 100. And I feel like at HBCUs in particular, this conversation gets tied up into morality. Because I feel like a lot of the schools are kind of, like, unofficially connected to, or, you know, very openly celebrate various forms of Christianity. And I don't know about y'all, but like the way dorms were managed was like the most, like the biggest thing for me, because, you know, you couldn't, I was in an all-girls dorm for my first 2 years, and we couldn't have any visitors, male or female, had to leave after a certain time.
That's changed now.
Has it changed? Oh, that's good. And I felt like at predominantly white schools that I knew that wasn't a thing. So, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yvette, I'm wondering, well, I guess you had a really interesting experience. Was it like, well, you kind of went into it before, but did you notice that?
Yeah. I did. So much of, I can't speak for all schools, but so much of Bennett in particular, and I love my school, but so much of it is tied up. We're a Baptist school. We go to chapel every Wednesday. You have to wear white. I mean, they weren't even allowing women to wear pants in chapel until the 90s. And so much of, especially if you are a student leader or perceived as a student leader, so much of what they consider dirt needs to be done off campus or out of the eye of the administration. So I can remember I was probably a junior. I had to be a junior going to my senior year. And I had taken on kind of all these leadership roles on campus, like running our student magazine. I was a resident assistant. I was running our NAACP chapter, just a whole bunch of stuff I didn't need to be doing, but was told I should be doing at that time. And I went to the club with my friends and, you know, just had a good time drinking, all of that. And when I came back to campus, that was a Thursday. On Monday, our student services coordinator pulled me in her office and gave me a whole lecture about needing to be a student leader. And when people see you off campus, like, you're a representation of the school. I mean, it was a whole spiel about essentially being on campus on time, being a leader both on and off campus, and making sure that my behavior was reflective of the school's reputation. And so a lot of the relationships that I had when I was in college were very private, of course, happened off campus because we didn't allow men on campus, and really reiterated to me that the things that I do in the dark should stay in the dark. Mm-hmm. Like, it's not community business. It's not something I need to share outside of my really close friend group. Like, what I was doing needed to be my own business. But I think on the flip side of that, I'm very fortunate that I never encountered sexual violence when I was in college. But had I don't know if I would have been comfortable coming to that same student service coordinator and saying, hey, I've been assaulted, given that I was basically lambasted for having fun as a college student.
Hmm. Now, Amos, you said that things had changed at Howard. So what is it like now? And like, what's the whole, like, how is sex talked about among students and administrators now?
I've seen it change big time from my freshman year to now going into my senior year. We have a lot of more panels. We have organizations that are strictly based on safe sex, like Safe Spaces, HU. Our campus does a lot of sexual assault stuff. And a lot of the fraternities and sororities on campus are definitely tackling that. And even from an administrative standpoint, we're actually launching this new campus safety program regarding sexual assault, dating violence, and interpersonal violence, similar to the It's On Us campaign, but a Howard version that we're dropping this fall. And it's one of the things that's actually talked about. It's like on every syllabus now. When you sign the syllabus, it's on the back of the syllabus for each class. And so it's we're actually moving in a good direction towards ensuring that making Howard University safe for all students. The student government is playing a big part in that as far as promoting new policies. We're actually doing a program with EverFi where students will have to take mandatory sexual assault prevention training, Title IX training, diversity and inclusion training before every semester online. And so we're implementing a lot of things to make sure and ensure that Howard University is a safe space for all students, male and female. Mm.
And Kyla, what's going on at Hampton? How is it there?
When we talk about like sex at Hampton, it's very like hush hush. Like, you don't talk about sex in public. You don't really talk about sex really at all. Like, they'll tell you have safe sex. Like, they might hand out condoms or something like at a seminar, at a panel, but it's not really something like Amos said at Howard, like it's not like that. We don't have a lot of organizations that are geared toward talking about sex and safe sex and just sexual activity in general. And even I've heard a lot of young women on campus talk about going to the health center about having a sore throat or having a chronic headache or something, and they end up turning it around and asking them like, oh, are you sexually active? You need to take a STD test. And it has nothing to do with the fact that I have a headache or the fact that my throat hurts, so why are you asking me about my sexual activity? And then that turns into judgment. And I've even seen like times where I've been to the health center about something that's completely unrelated to anything sexual, where they've asked the question of, are you sexually active? Do you know how many partners you have? And it's very uncomfortable. And even when you answer the questions, the reactions, you can see the reactions in the nurse's face. If it's like, oh, I'm not sexually active, and they're like, oh, good, keep it that way. Or, yeah, I'm sexually active. Oh, well, why? Like, it's just, it's very weird. It's very uncomfortable. It makes a lot of students on campus uncomfortable, because for me to come to somewhere that's supposed to be, one, a confidential resource, and two, somewhere for me to check on my health and my well-being, I shouldn't be judged here. So that is one thing that's very awkward. And two, when it comes to sexual assault, sexual violence, things of that nature on campus, the only resource that we really have the students are semi-comfortable with and just now becoming more comfortable with is the Student Counseling Center, which has a program called the Peer Advocates, which I'll actually be the president of this upcoming school year. And it's a organization, or it's a program that specifically is geared towards sexual assault, dating violence, stalking, domestic violence, etc. And it's that organization that everyone kind of wants to be a part of or wants to talk to, but at the same time wants to shy away from, because it's all the taboo topics that everyone wants to keep quiet about as well. So we're trying to make it more of an open discussion and an open dialogue, because it shouldn't be something that's kept quiet on campus, especially because it happens so often. And in my research, I've come to find out that in the average 4-year tenure, 1 in 5 women are sexually assaulted on a college campus. So there's no reason why we should continuously be quiet when it's happening every day to different people and no one's doing anything about it. So Hampton is definitely going through it right now when it comes to the sexual assault realm. So as far as Amos talked about at Howard and having sexual assault seminars every semester and having it on your syllabus, we're definitely not there yet. And that's hopefully a direction that we're headed to, but we're not anywhere close as of right now.
Kyla, I know that I'm glad to hear that you're going to lead the Peer Advocates, and I'm glad that Hampton is kind of moving forward slowly but surely. I'm wondering if you could actually share a little bit more about your experience and how you got to know all these services so well.
Mm-hmm. So my freshman year at Hampton, unfortunately, I was a part of that statistic. So I was assaulted on campus by someone who I thought was my friend, someone who was a prominent figure on campus, someone who I was very comfortable with. So at that time, I was extremely, like, I shut down from the world. Like, I shut down from everyone, everything. I was not talking about it. I was not even admitting the fact that it happened. Like, I was just like, I don't really know what it is, but it's not that. I don't know. I'm just not going to talk about it. And then after I finally started talking to my parents and started talking to really close friends and family members, I started figuring out that, and doing research, I started figuring out that obviously I wasn't alone and it wasn't just me. So I had to try to figure out in some way, shape, or form how to be that voice and how to come out about this situation, because it was happening to other people. And obviously they weren't speaking out about it either. And this is when I began to, well, I didn't report it until about 4 months after it happened. And then even after I did, so I started to learn the process and how it worked on campus as far as reporting it and if you got a case or if you didn't get a case and how Hampton solved the situation or if they didn't solve the situation and all that. And then my sophomore year, I created a platform called Operation SASH. SASH is an acronym for Sexual Assault Stops Here. And I competed in the Miss Black and Gold scholarship pageant, and that was my platform throughout the entire, yes, Amos. So that was my platform during the entire pageant and even after the pageant. So I placed second. So my title was Miss Gamma Iota, which is our chapter on campus of Alpha Phi Alpha Fraternity Incorporated. And so I stood by that platform. And even though I hadn't actually won the pageant, I still used that platform to help other women on campus. So that was that. My sophomore year, my junior year, I once again competed in another pageant. So I competed as Miss Hampton University in the scholarship pageant. I placed again. I didn't win, but I still kept the platform going. So in continuously keeping the platform going, only reason I'm, well, not the only reason, but one of the reasons why I'm competing constantly is so I can have a greater name behind me than just myself, because I can't be a standalone entity and get my message out the way that I want to. So I've still, but like I said, through the Peer Advocates program, so that was a program that I started, well, I didn't start it, I joined my sophomore year. So and having the support of that group and the mentors who were in the group and the other young ladies who were a part of it, which is another way how I gained my confidence in speaking out about this issue. So once again, in my senior year, I will be competing for Miss Hampton University with a platform that also is pretty similar, but I want to kind of switch it up a little bit because I want to talk about more issues than just sexual assault, but I still want to keep sexual assault definitely under the umbrella of my platform. So definitely look out for that. And hopefully this year I will take the title away, so I'll be all around Hampton, Hampton Roads, and the DMV, you know, speaking about this issue that needs to be talked about in such a vital time right now.
Well, first of all, thank you. Yeah, thank you for sharing. I feel like you're turning, awesome. Yeah. Like, I hate to say the cliche, but you're like totally growing from this. This is amazing. I'm curious. And I'm going to open this up to everybody else, but were you believed, like, when you first came forward, do you feel like people believed you, or did you feel like you had to, like, prove something to the people asking you questions and, like, that you, what the experience you had mm-hmm. was real?
Yeah, no. Like, no one believed me. Even after mm-hmm. I finally came to terms with it, like, all my friends, I was in a group of about 8 friends that were, like, my main friends. We all stayed on the same hall in our dorm and everything. We were literally in each other's rooms every single day, talked about everything under the sun. And it was like, when I came out to my friends and told them what happened, it was like, did it really? Okay, we'll help you, okay. And then after it started to get real, like it seemed like the more comfortable I got with it, the more uncomfortable they got with it. And so I ended up losing all my friends freshman year. So I literally had none of them, so all 7 of them, all turned their backs on me. They were like, no, I don't really think this is how this is supposed to go. I don't really know if this did happen to you, if you're trying to get attention or what you're trying to do, but this is not the way to go. And I'm like, what do you mean this isn't the way to go? Like, I reported it to the university. I'm trying to get him kicked off campus, like, whatever. And it literally went, like, everything I was trying to do to keep my support system strong, it backfired on me, honestly. So it was them, and then after I got, so when you report the incident to the Title IX office or to HUPD, they have an investigation with you and the person you say was the assailant, and they decide whether or not you get a case. So not all people get a case, and yeah, not all people don't get a case. So I got a case, so I had to go in front of a board of administrators and talk about what happened. He was there. He was in the room. I ended up finding out that wasn't supposed to happen that way.
He was in the room?
He wasn't supposed to be in the same room as me.
That's against Title IX.
Yes, it was weird. It was really weird. It was the most awkward thing ever. Yeah. Mm. So that happened, and it was like the administration were like grilling me. They're just like, what did you have on? Well, why were you at his house? Well, why were you this? Well, why were you that? And I'm like, what? Wait, hold on. Pause. Stop. What? So it was just the most awkward thing ever. And then it was him and they're like, oh yeah, like she's lying. She texts me that night. And I'm like, what is me texting you have to do with the fact that I told you I didn't want this to happen? Like, that literally doesn't make sense. So I literally, it was a very alone time in my life. So I'm glad, obviously, I'm not there anymore, because during that time, I literally couldn't talk about it without busting out in tears, without crying and having anxiety attacks. So clearly I've grown, which is, I think, the greatest thing that has happened out of this whole situation, that I've grown and that I can help other people that have gone through this that may not be as strong now in their time that I am in my time, so I can help them. But yeah, so moral of the story is it was very difficult. No one believed me except really my family, like my close family. But yeah, so I had to really grow from that and try to figure out how to navigate and manage by myself.
Wow. I'm wondering for Yvette and Amos, like, So it sounds like what I learned from Kyla is that she had to kind of prove herself to her friends and to the administration. And I'm wondering, at your campuses, did you find that the student body is supportive when they hear about sexual assault cases? And then, you know, I'm wondering if your friends or people you know who have experienced sexual assault, if they have felt comfortable in the, you know, the administration space and also the social space at campus.
I can say at Howard, you run into our couple of issues when it comes to Title IX and sexual assault on our campus as well. And I'm sure I can only speak from a male's perspective to make that on the record. So I'm not really sure about like how a lot of women feel, but I've known from attending panels and being in SGA, a lot of women aren't as inclined to report because they have friends or they know people that have reported and haven't seen an output. But again, I think that we're moving in the right direction with that, like looking to hire more Title IX investigators. Because I think one of the things that really hurts HBCUs, especially when it comes to issues like these, is that the resources we have are very slim. So instead of trying to find creative ways, we overcompensate and aren't honest about the issues that we have going on our campuses. Because there's creative ways to assist survivors and to discipline assailants and like those type of individuals that don't need to be on our campus. And so I think Howard is trying to find creative ways to, outside of the resources that we don't have, to really, really tackle this issue. And again, like I said, I can only speak from a male's perspective. But also, we've had some cases where male sexual assault and domestic violence has happened as well. And so it's something that like really hits home for me, because as a guy, unlike Aaron, I didn't have my own personal experience, but like my mentee, like one of the closest women to me on campus, that happened to her. And so when that happened to her, like I was the first person she called. I took her to the interpersonal violence office, and because she was afraid to report, and I was like, no, like as a student employee of the university, like as soon as you tell me, and now I'm required to report it myself. And so like now I have to. I know that I may break our mentee-mentor relationship trust here, but I have to, and I think it'll serve you well with me doing so. And it really put it into action for me to like, okay, now like. And I hate the fact that it had to take somebody happening to me close for me to really, really, really put my hands to the plow to make it a priority for my administration and for other student leaders. So now it's my job to make sure it doesn't take another woman, another male to experience the same type of thing for them to get involved, like explaining to them and showing them why everyone needs to put this high on their priority list to make sure that our campus is safe for men and women to attend an institution.
Yeah. What about you, Yvette?
Well, my college is a little complicated because we haven't reported a sexual assault in nearly 5 years, which based on national statistics is inaccurate. And it's impossible that there is no sexual assault that has happened on Bennett College's campus in 5 years. But what that indicates to me is that we either don't have the proper protocols in place for victims of sexual violence to come forward and feel as if they'll be believed and that justice will be served, or these cases are being swept under the rug. And there's no evidence either way, but I can recall, especially when I was at the beginning of my undergraduate career, there were always whispers and rumors about students who had been sexually violated, but it was always happening among student groups or among groups of friends. It was never happening on an administrative level. Like, we were never having town hall meetings about sexual violence. We were never publicly discussing issues like this. And so often I can recall one specific student in particular who said that she had been raped. And the next semester, she didn't come back and we never saw her again. And so much of the conversation around sexual assault and rape and how colleges handle it does, as Amos said, has to do with resources. So Bennett is a school with 500 students. They rely mostly on student tuition to fund the institution. 90% of the time we are either facing financial probation or we're on financial probation. And so when it comes to the strategic way that they allocate resources, it's as if they don't see curbing sexual assault and making sure that those who have been assaulted have the proper resources as a institutional priority. And so I don't know if there's been a movement recently to try to change that, but the last time I looked, it had been 5 years since we'd reported a sexual assault.
So you, Amos and Yvette, bring up two really interesting points. One is, how big of a deal is sexual assault to students and administrators on these campuses? And is it seen, you know, in comparison to all the other issues that come with being typically underfunded or, you know, lacking resources? Like, where does it fit, do you guys think? And also, you know, it sounds like schools underreport crime so that they don't get a bad rep and that, you know, people, they're ranked high on the best colleges in the U.S., whatever ranking that is. And, you know, HBCUs in particular, like, it's harder if they're already lacking funding and they're struggling with enrollment, which many of them are. Hearing about a sexual assault issue probably won't help. So I'm wondering, I don't know, what do you guys think about that? And, like, where do you think that ranks in how your school deals with things?
Oh, that's a great question.
Go ahead, Yvette.
Yeah, I think reputation for HBCUs is everything, primarily because they are underfunded. And so the things that administrations choose to prioritize and focus on are designed to increase enrollment. And so for Bennett in particular, it's one of at least three schools in Greensboro and one of five or six schools in North Carolina, and it has one of the highest tuitions because it's a private institution. And so anything that will detract a family from sending their daughter to Bennett is not going to be considered a priority. Like, they are not going to put it in the national news how they're handling Title IX because it may deter someone from sending their daughter to the school. And so, I don't know what the next step could be in order to start correcting that. But I do think if they make a promise to families that your child will be safe here, that they need to follow through on that promise. And a large part of that is making sure that any person who reports being sexually assaulted gets the proper resources and goes through a protocol that ensures that the right outcome is reached.
Right. Amos, what were you going to say?
Right. I think that HBCUs as a whole have a very big problem when it comes to being reactive instead of proactive. Because a lot of the issues that arise at HBCUs, or even from Title IX to dorms, to a lot of the issues that most HBCUs deal with, they're reactive instead of proactive. And I think especially on this issue, because it's always when something hits big that, like, HBCUs make the decision to go in and handle them, instead of having those serious conversations with your students to let you know what's going on. And I think that was one of the results of our student protest, is that, like, it's not a matter that we hate Howard. We hate the fact that we don't have a decision. We don't have a seat at the table when it comes to these decisions, when it comes to these policies being made at our institution. And even when you pick the students, you only pick the students that you know will align or just agree with what you're going to push at the table, instead of allowing someone to push back a little bit, to challenge you. And I think it's imperative for HBCUs to do that, because especially for Howard's case, we love to compare ourselves to the other top-tier institutions and consider ourselves an HBCU, Ivy, et cetera, et cetera. But what those other institutions do, a lot of them, some of them don't do as well, is, like, they have committees for everything. And on all of those committees, there's equal representation from students, faculty, staff, and the community that it supports. And so I think it's imperative that we do that across HBCUs. And especially when it comes to the topic of sexual assault and domestic violence and dating violence, I think it's very imperative that you also have women that are in leadership on these campuses that are actually being able to advocate on the behalf of other women. And I think that's one of the things that our president has done. It's been a constant trend of more women as deans and in leadership on campus, because sadly enough, wish this can change, and hopefully it will, that men aren't going to advocate the same way that women will. And that's one of the things that I had to learn myself, is that you're going to all of these events and you're hosting these events with the Alphas and SGA, and it ain't nothing but men talking about things that men aren't experiencing on this campus. And so really just popping down, sitting down and listening and understanding how you fit into this construct that is like living as a woman at an HBCU on a college campus in America as a whole. Because if you look at across like from higher education to politics to entertainment, it's like, where are Black women safe? And so if it's not at institutions, like it needs to be, that needs to be the first priority. And I think we're trying to do the right thing, but again, it's an aspect of being reactive instead of proactive, because this is something that should have been handled a long time.
You know, I feel like the way we've been talking about sexual assault, we're talking about it in terms of student-to-student violence. And I'm wondering, do you think students on campus feel safe with administrators and faculty? You know, because I know sometimes students date professors or staff. Do you think there are good protocols to make sure those relationships are kosher?
Definitely not. Just as far as the culture, the way that it's changed in the last year, because in this past school year we had our town hall meeting that kind of went viral, I guess, on Twitter, and it was focused around sexual assault. That's not what the purpose was. The purpose was just to talk about any issues going on campus, and a young lady came to the mic because, you went to the mic, asked the administration a question, they answered it, possibly proposed a solution, and that was it. And she came to the mic and she said, I was raped. I reported it. You guys didn't do anything about it. I see him all the time. I don't feel safe on campus. And, you know, this is a problem. And in mid-sentence, the president of the university went to the mic and told her to stop talking. And he just completely shut her down. And that was that. And it was kind of a cover-up type of situation, is the way that students perceived it. I'm not talking from my personal perspective, but what I've read on Twitter from different tweets and everything, and just talking to my peers. And they said that a lot of students feel this way, especially because our Title IX, it was reported in the Virginia Pilot, if I'm not mistaken. Okay, don't quote me on that. I'm just going to say it was reported in a newspaper in the DMV area that Hampton and William and Mary were both under investigation for the way that their Title IX offices handle sexual assault. And it was like a civil rights investigation or a civil investigation about both universities' Title IX offices. And the young lady, she had literally all of her facts straight. She had all of her receipts. She had her phone with the article pulled up, and she started reading it, and she was reading over the president. He was yelling at her, and she was yelling at him, and it was like back and forth. And he was telling her that Hampton wasn't under investigation for sexual assault. We were under a civil rights investigation. And it was like, okay, well, the sexual assault office was under a civil rights investigation. So the way that I feel like sometimes things are handled, clearly they aren't handled correctly. They aren't handled properly. And even in that article, it has stated that it had only been a couple sexual assault cases reported within the last couple of years, which we all know statistically based and just with talking to our peers that that's not necessarily true. So students don't feel safe on campus. That's why a lot of students, like someone said earlier, don't report them, because if you already see that people have been reporting and they don't get the proper outcomes that they're looking for, then, you know, what's going to make you different than the last person? So a lot of young women, even young men, because, you know, men can get assaulted as well, they don't feel comfortable with reporting. They don't want to deal with backlash. They don't want to deal with harassment. They don't want, you know, someone coming after them. So they just prefer to stay quiet, don't say anything about it, push it under the rug. Or even a lot of students, how they leave and transfer. And even with my own situation, I looked up 2 or 3 universities to transfer to my freshman year because I was not dealing with it anymore. But it's very difficult to transfer out of Hampton because of the way that our credits are set up, and we have a lot of classes for our majors that other universities don't have. So 9 times out of 10, when you transfer, you'll be pushed back. And when I looked into that, that's how I was going to be. I was going to end up being a freshman again going into my sophomore year, and I didn't want to waste more money and waste more time. So I ended up kind of trying to flip the negative into a positive and just staying and doing what I needed to do as far as my education as well as being an advocate on campus. So that's the way that I try to fight with it, but not everyone has that same mindset. So if they don't feel safe, they don't feel safe, they leave. And that, I definitely do not take that away from anyone. It's commendable, honestly, because you left from the situation, but why should you have to, because Hampton was my dream school, so why should I have to leave my dream university because of what someone else did, because right. of the way that someone else acted and they misbehaved, and why can't they be the ones displaced instead of me? So he still went to Hampton, he graduated, everything, he's I guess living his best life, what he would think. So I mean, that's him, that's me, but that's not fair, because when he was still in undergrad, I took the proper protocol, I took the necessary steps to make sure that he didn't proceed. But that was Hampton felt like, I guess, he wasn't a danger to other students on campus. So that was that. So other students definitely don't feel safe.
So, wow. We've kind of discussed that, like, sexual assault goes underreported. And I feel like, I guess my question for you all is, do you think that has anything to do with the fact that, A, you know, Black people are already overrepresented in the prison system and the jail, and you're not trying to add to that? And B, there's kind of like this family, quote unquote, culture at HBCUs. And so it feels bad to kind of like tell on your brother, or your sister. Do you think that's part of what goes on?
Yes, absolutely. I actually, one of my professors always says that most HBCUs run like a Black church. And that is very much the case at Bennett. And so they approach it as, we put on a united front, even if we have inner turmoil. And so you are never supposed to speak badly of the school. You don't speak badly of other students. At Bennett, we call each other sisters, and you always treat your sisters the way that you would want to be treated. And so there is this air, no matter how false it may be, that we don't put a crack in the armor that's unnecessary. So anything that happens on our campus stays on our campus, and that we handle it internally. And I think that may be a large part of the reason why Bennett is, if sexual assault is happening, and based on national statistics, it probably is, why they are not reporting it.
Hmm. Yeah, I think that also plays into regional placement of institutions as well. Because I know, like, a lot of the students that we attract to go to Howard are coming from large cities and a lot of progressive cities, especially on the social, political aspect of things. And so we've actually seen an increase in reporting over the last couple of years, which is a double-edged sword, because you're like, we're glad people are reporting, but we're also sad that people have to report something.
Right.
And so it's one of those things to where I totally agree that even at Howard, you still have that aspect of keeping it in-house, and what happens at home stays at home, and we don't want to affect this Black man's future, this Black woman's future. But they affected yours. And so you have to understand that, like, no, we really need to have these tough conversations. And I really think even before you even reach the institution, I think it's something that needs to be had at home before you even take off to go to your institution, that we create a very trusting, open environment, especially around sex and about dating and things of those nature at home. Because a lot of the times, for a lot of students that we've surveyed on campus, it's like the first time they've openly talked about sex with an adult or older than them, an elder person, was in college. Like, that's weird, sad.
Hmm. Yeah. So what Amos just said definitely just stuck out to me. Like, you don't want to affect someone's future, but they affected yours. That was literally the mindset I had after. Mm-hmm. Because at first, that's literally what I was thinking of. I'm like, no, like, he's trying to graduate, because obviously he's older than me. I'm like, no, he's trying to get his degree and go on to do all these great things and this and this and that. And then also, because we're from the same place, I didn't want people at home to find out, so then they would be looking at me weird and looking at him weird, and just be a really weird situation and all that. So like I had said earlier, it took me about 4 months to finally come to terms with myself and say, no, forget all that, because you shouldn't care about his future because he didn't care about yours. Because think about all the long lasting, because there's a list that's way too long of lasting effects that happen to people who are assaulted, because it's obviously a traumatic experience. So you didn't think about everything that could or would happen to me. So why should I care about what happens to you? So that's really something that I want to stress to anyone out there who has been assaulted. His future does not matter because yours didn't matter to him either.
And a lot of the time statistics show, like, when they do it once, it's not just once.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yes, because I found out about other people who he had assaulted before me. So it's never, like, it's never just one person.
And I'll just add that there's debates about that. There are people who have statistics that say people will, if you did it once, they'll do it again. There are people who are like, no, it's not true. So I feel like, I mean, I think it's the debate with statistics is really interesting. I know we're coming to an end, and I feel like I have like two more things I want to ask you guys. You know, we're in this Me Too moment, and I'm wondering how this has affected your conversations on campus, and also kind of like, you know, what people consume on campus. Like, I still can't get over that R. Kelly has I Admit out, and Drake did take, you know, what is that song? Nice for What? Like, I feel like there are these more progressive songs, and yet then I also see really misogynistic things all the time. So I'm just curious, like, what, how has that affected your conversations about sex and sexual assault?
Well, Bitch Media is a feminist publication, and so much of the work that I do, I don't get to write much anymore, which is quite sad. But much of the work that I do with cultivating writers is getting them to tackle these kind of difficult issues. And what I found since, especially because we're approaching the 1 year anniversary of Me Too, is that there are far more people who are willing to have these conversations and to have them publicly. And I think social media has played a big part in that, in terms of being able to respond immediately to, say, R. Kelly's terrible 19-minute song, I Admit, or being able to foster a conversation publicly in a way that they may not be able to do in their own families, especially if they're encountering pushback. And so I would hope that that is mirroring what's happening on college campuses as well, because I really do have hope that because, you know, people who are, say, queer are able to see so much of themselves online and create communities, that we're creating a new generation of people who are much more willing to have these difficult conversations in public to evolve their own worldview. And so I don't know if Me Too is really the catalyst for that. I think it's been happening prior to that, particularly among feminists online. But I think that we are shifting national consciousness about what sexual violence looks like, what sexual assault looks like, and the way that institutions, not just colleges, but institutions, I'm thinking of NBC, who has quelled so many of these stories about sexual violence, how these institutions work to protect people who are already powerful, and how they turn out the powerless. And so I think the fact that we are even having this conversation right now about how HBCU specifically handles sexual assault signals that that we're in the middle of a sea change around this conversation.
Right. And I agree. Like, I think similar to the political engagement, civic engagement of Black people that stemmed from Donald Trump and people like him being elected into office and that whole Roy Moore situation, there was a silver lining in it, because it also made people more aware that, like, if a guy got elected president of the United States, it has to be happening at least down the street from you. So really, like, changing that whole, and the same thing to where people went out in droves and voted and got involved civically, I think it's still, I think we're going to see a response to that too, following Me Too and all of these prominent people that you used to look up to, and now you're like, wow, like, how can I not condemn and really change the conversation? Because it's still, even though that is happening, you still see in the NFL, for example, to where a guy gets committed for sexual assault or domestic violence and gets 3 to 4 games for that, but also gets 3 to 4 games for kneeling for injustice and expressing the First Amendment right. So we still have a big issue, but I think the conversations are happening at a much more of a rate that will continue to push the envelope. Because again, you're starting to see more women get elected across the country. You're starting to see more women become presidents across the country at different institutions. And so I think the more and more women are leading the charge, as women have always have when it comes to really bringing about change, I think it's really going to really garner support across institutions. Because even like, for example, there's a silent majority, and it's sad because even at Howard, where the ratio is 7 to 1, the most popular people on campus are guys, and it just makes no sense. And so it's just like, and so like, how do you fit into that as a guy, and making sure that you're ensuring that the women are safe on your campus with all of this quote unquote clout that you have. And so really pushing these type of conversations to where, like, even fraternities on our campus host and partner with sororities on our campus to have these type of conversations where we just listen and really encouraging people to understand that there's a problem and that we need to solve it.
I would just say pretty much the same as everyone just said. Like, because Me Too is coming up on its 1 year anniversary, since then, like, even in the last almost year, and seeing how many celebrities have come out and said that this has happened to them, and with Harvey Weinstein and everything, just it's becoming more of an open dialogue, luckily. So I think that we can only move forward from here. It's moving slowly. I thought that we were going to move a little quicker. But, you know, when things come out in its initial stages, that's when things move fast. But as time progresses, it kind of just kind of slows down a little bit. So I think, you know, here and there, like, as more celebrities come out, because celebrities are the ones that are at the forefront, that, you know, we're the ones who are the most familiar with them because we see them on our movies and our TV shows and in music. So they're the ones who we feel like that we kind of can sympathize with because we feel like we know them when we really don't. So celebrities are the ones whose voices we hear loud and clear, even though sometimes it could be the person who's literally sitting right next to you and it could be them. So I think that we have to move the dialogue from celebrities and the Me Too and the Time's Up to your neighbor, your brother, your sister, your cousin, whoever, so we can hear them as well, because there is a Me Too in your actual circle and you probably didn't even know it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, guys, last question.
I think even so, regarding Me Too, it's so sad that Me Too was started by a black woman, but it didn't really garner support until a white woman.
And no one knew.
And no one knew until a white woman said something about Me Too. Mm. So that's even something that even goes into a deeper aspect of like HBCUs and just appropriating of black culture, to where the same things that happened to Bill Cosby didn't happen to Harvey Weinstein. And so it just shows, it's sad, and I hate to do that comparison because they're both wrong, but it just shows that even in something that's just like sad upon humankind, there's still division and segregation on the results of the issue.
Right. That's so real. Okay, guys. So for my last question, I just wanted to hear from each of you one thing, just one, that you're really hopeful that this will help change things, bring about more change on campus. Like, if it's a policy, if it's a conversation, whatever it is, what do you like? I think that's going to be really good.
The one thing that I hope changes moving forward is that I would just like Bennett to have one town hall. Every school have one town hall. Every HBCU have one town hall that allows students to voice how they feel, particularly around issues that are vital and that must stop. And I know until that happens, until students' voices are heard or valued or respected, I think these issues will continue to happen with either the administration not knowing or not caring or not being invested in making sure that the students are safe.
I would definitely say the dialogue, because when the town hall meeting happened it was, everyone was outraged and everyone was upset and everyone had something to say as far as students. And now it's kind of died down and no one's talking about it anymore, and that's that. So I don't want it to be just a temporary upset, a temporary conversation. Like, this needs to be ongoing until something actually happens. And that's the thing that really matters the most to me, being that this means so much to me because I've been in this situation and everyone was so supportive of everyone who this has happened to, and they were so sympathetic, and that lasted for like a month. So we don't need to be temporary when it comes to permanent situations. We need to continuously keep the same momentum, keep trying to talk to administration, and keep actually moving toward change on our campus.
I would love to see men on our campus just listen. Men on our campus listen, understand, and seek information on how they can be an ally to women on our campus. Like, I would love to see that from the band, from fraternities, from sororities, from athletic teams. I would love for men to just sit and listen to the issues that our counterparts at Howard are dealing with. And a follow-up to that, can I ask a question?
Yeah, of course.
Like, what do the three of you want from black men when it comes to this issue?
I would say that I agree with you, Amos, that I want black men to listen, but I also want them to hold other black men accountable. R. Kelly does not sustain without people, and it's black women, too, who are invested in buying his concerts and making sure that his music, I mean, after Spotify banned him from playlists, his streams increased. Wow. And so I think it's a matter of holding the people closest to you accountable. And it's not just once they violate someone. It's in their language and their everyday behavior. Like, how are they perpetuating sexism and rape culture and the things that they say in the way that they interact with women? And how can other men call them out in a way that fosters change?
I would agree. Definitely accountability. But in addition to accountability, a lot of men, they band together. This is what I've seen on my campus. Because when the town hall meeting happened and women were coming out saying that this had been happening to them or this has happened to them on our campus during, you know, their college career, it was a lot of men, surprisingly, who were like, oh, if somebody blames my bro for this, like, I'm gonna come and find you. Like, threatening, literally sending threats to women. And it was the scariest time on campus, and I had to leave. Because it was, we had a Curious Cat page. If you guys know what that is, it's like an anonymous. You can type things anonymously, and people can respond to it. And women were anonymously telling their stories. And some guy, apparently, I don't know, he said, if I find somebody lying on my bro's name, you getting two to the head. And I was like, what? Y'all are not serious. You literally cannot be serious. So definitely, in addition to accountability, like, you're literally a part of the problem. You didn't do it, but the fact that you're trying to, I guess, protect your brother, whatever, I don't know what they consider it, but it's clearly it's not helping. It's hurting even more.
I agree with what I've heard. I had an experience. I'm a podcast producer, and there was a guest that on the show that was flirting with me in front of my boss and another guest, and it really just felt like an old boys club. Like, everybody was kind of just like laughing, and you know, as a producer, you're kind of like there to make things go well, and you want the guest to feel good, and you don't want to say anything. But it was kind of like, how do I say this is inappropriate? Please stop. Without killing the vibe. And I later discussed it with my boss, and I was like, I really needed you to say something, because you're the host, and you have a clout that I don't. And at first he put it back on me, and he was like, well, you need to, you know, figure out something to say. And he's not wrong. I do. But also, I am not a man, who you're looking at, you're the host, like, you have the power. And I think he ended up hearing what I had to say. And so I don't know, you know, hopefully that situation won't happen again. And I don't even know if it'll happen, you know, he'll act in the way that I asked, but at least my boss will be thinking about it, you know? Mm-hmm. And so that's what I'd like to see more too. Just like men kind of like telling other men, okay, that's not cool, without having, you know, women do need to speak up, but sometimes everybody doesn't hear us.